Welcome to Beyond the Divide, where we cut through the noise to uncover the truth that no matter our differences, we're all just people and we're united in a pursuit of a better tomorrow. Join us as we challenge the divide, celebrate our shared humanity, and build a future for ourselves, our families, and our nation. Yesterday was a pretty important day for my daughter. We spent half the day at the 4-H State Horse Show, where she did a series of shows with our little filly that she has spent the better part of a year training for these shows. And basically, the shows consist of three separate parts. So she has to lead the horse through a predetermined pattern while there's a judge that's watching her. And then she has to perform a lunge line, where the horse has to walk, trot, and lope, going both counterclockwise and clockwise in a matter of 90 seconds. And then there's what they call the trail pattern, where they perform a series of obstacles such as backing, side passing, dragging things. They go through gates, they go over bridges, okay, all this crazy stuff. So I know that this doesn't really sound like it would be all that difficult, but these young kids that do this, they're between the ages of 8 and 18. And the whole point to the season is that these kids are training these horses by themselves. So they're taking a yearling horse who has had very little to do with people or leading or, you know, anything. They're just babies. And they're training them up to do all of these things. And the pair, the horse and the trainer, they have to learn complete trust in one another. The trainer sometimes has to teach the horse that they need to do something that is going against the animal's instincts and natural tendencies. And it can become very difficult and very frustrating at times for both the horse and the trainer, especially when, after hours and hours and hours of training, your horse can still decide not to cooperate with you. Sometimes animals are just crazy and they're just like, I have a mind of my own. I can do whatever I want to. And I know you're asking me to do something specific, but I really don't want to do that right now. So I'm not going to. And after hours and hours of training them to be able to do this, when it's showtime, they just decide they're not going to cooperate. And in the 4-H competition, each part has a separate score. So you've got all of these different things that they're doing, and they're scored differently. And there are four levels of scoring. So you've got blue, red, white, and then orange, which is basically disqualified from the event. And the scores are extremely competitive, and oftentimes the difference between first and fifth is a matter of a couple of points. And the kids are extremely competitive, and they are very invested in these animals. They've put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears literally into these animals to train them. And sometimes when it doesn't go their way, the disappointment that registers on the faces of these kids is palpable. And you can tell how their specific show went just by seeing the look on their face. And our day didn't really turn out quite like my daughter had hoped. And after it was all over, we spent a very long 45-minute drive home with a very disappointed teenage girl. And I know that the generation of youth today have a very difficult time knowing how to deal with disappointment, and how to pick up and how to move forward, and how to Except that things aren't always going to go the way that you want them to go. And sometimes that is for a better purpose, and sometimes it's just because it just didn't work out this time. So I want to tell you guys a story of another boy in the Bible. And he was a shepherd, and he had also been chosen by God for a great purpose. It's kind of like a recurring theme in the Bible. We have these young men who are shepherds, and God is like, you might be a shepherd right now, but I have great things in store for you. So here we are, somewhere around about 1800 BC. In the Old Testament, it's really hard to know for sure the year of these things happening. Like, we kind of have guesses, but the Old Testament isn't really good at being like, this was 1800 BC. So this is kind of a guess, but it was somewhere around there. And this story is kind of what I consider the beginning of God's promise to Abraham. Because God promised Abraham that because of his faith and obedience, that he would multiply Abraham's seed as the stars of heaven and the sand which is upon the seashore. And at the time that God told him that, Abraham didn't have very many children, and he had just been asked to sacrifice his only son. And so he was kind of distraught, and he was kind of disheartened that he had waited so long for Isaac to be born, and suddenly Isaac is born and he's, you know, somewhere around 10 or 12 years old. And then God all of a sudden is like, okay, now you're going to sacrifice him to me. And I can't even imagine being asked to do that. But Abraham was faithful. And through his faith and his willingness, now God is blessing him. And he blesses him with a massive posterity. And he, you know, his daughter-in-law, Rebecca, who marries Isaac, is promised that she will be the mother of millions. And so kind of here we have the start of this great posterity. And so several years after this promise to Abraham, his grandson Jacob has 12 sons. Now, if you remember the story of Jacob, he was a young man and he came upon a beautiful woman named Rachel at a well. And this is like love at first sight. He instantly falls in love with Rachel. And so he goes around, he finds out who her father is. And then he goes to him and he tells him that he wants to marry Rachel. And he says, I will serve you for 7 years. And in payment, at the end of that 7 years, you will give me Rachel to be my wife. And so her father agrees, and Jacob labors for 7 years. And then after that 7 years is over, Rachel's father, his name is Laban, and he tricks Jacob into marrying her older sister, Leah. And Jacob doesn't realize this until the morning after the wedding. And then he goes to Laban and he's like, what in the heck did you just do to me? Like, you promised me if I worked for you for 7 years that you would give me Rachel. And then you tricked me into marrying Leah. And so Laban gives Jacob this whole story about how they have this tradition or this law that the younger daughter cannot be married before the older daughter. So he had to give him Leah because it's against the law to give him Rachel. And Jacob is like, okay, whatever. But I still want Rachel. So Laban tells him, okay, take Leah and if you work for me for another 7 years, then I'll give you Rachel too. And so Jacob labors another 7 years, and he is able to take Rachel for his wife after that point. And Jacob is so in love with Rachel. And so when she becomes his wife, he starts ignoring Leah. And when God sees that he's ignoring Leah, he's pretty upset with Jacob. And so God decides that he's going to make Leah fertile, very fertile, and he's going to make Rachel barren. And so we go on like this for a while. Leah bears sons, and Rachel becomes quite depressed because she can't have kids. She hasn't had kids, and she's begging Jacob to give her children. And he's like, I can't give you children. I didn't make you barren. You know, like, we've tried. It's not happening. I don't know what else you want me to do. And so she ends up giving Jacob her handmaid in marriage. And she's like, if I can't have children myself, then I'll give you my handmaid and she will give you children for me. And so we go on like this. The handmaid has a couple of sons, and Leah comes to the point where she can no longer have children due to age. And so she decides then that she's going to give Jacob her handmaid to bear more children for her. And so we kind of have this sister rivalry going on, and they just keep upping the ante. And eventually we end up with 12 sons, and there are some daughters, but it doesn't talk a whole lot about the daughters. It mainly focuses on the sons. So now we have 12 sons. And Jacob is a shepherd, so naturally his sons are raised in the fields and they become shepherds. But eventually, God finds favor with Rachel, and he allows her to have two children, Joseph and Benjamin. She dies in childbirth after Benjamin is born. But she has these two sons. So Joseph becomes Jacob's favorite, and he's highly favored. He is taught, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic. He's more than just a shepherd, and he doesn't have to labor the same way that his brothers do. And so this causes a lot of contempt and jealousy among his brothers. And one day they decide that they've had enough. And Joseph starts having these dreams, and he starts recounting these dreams to his family. And he's telling them that in his dreams, you know, he has dreams about shafts of wheat and stars in the sky. And he interprets them to mean that his brothers and his family are going to bow down to him one day. And so this really, like, sends his brothers over the edge. They're pretty ticked. And they're like, who are you to say that we're going to bow to you? You're our younger brother. Why would we ever do that? And so they go out into the field, and for whatever reason, Joseph is sent to find them. And so Joseph goes out to find them, and they have hatched a plan that they're going to throw him into a pit and they're going to kill him. And the eldest brother is, you know, kind of finally sees common sense. And he's like, we can't kill our brother. He's still our brother. I know we don't like him, and he's kind of a pain in the butt, but we can't kill him. And so they decide they're going to throw him into this pit. And then the plan kind of ends up morphing into them deciding to sell him to a slave trader for 20 pieces of silver. And after he's sold to the slave trader, he ends up in Egypt. And he's purchased by Potiphar's house. So he becomes a slave in Potiphar's house. And Potiphar is the captain of the Pharaoh's guard. So he's pretty important. And one day his wife decides that she is going to try to seduce Joseph. And Joseph tells her that he's loyal to Potiphar and he has faith in God and he cannot do this thing. He refuses her. And it makes her very, very angry. And so she ends up telling Potiphar that Joseph attacked her. And so Potiphar has no choice but to throw Joseph into prison. And at this point, he has risen from a slave, scrubbing the floors to managing the affairs of Potiphar's house. Everything. Like he was the accountant, he was the manager of all of the other slaves. He kept track of Potiphar's lands, all of this stuff. So he has risen up to be a leader in Potiphar's home, and Potiphar has no other recourse but to throw him into prison. So he ends up in prison. And this is kind of another really devastating time of disappointment for Joseph. But once again, he is like, I'm just going to make the most out of this situation. And eventually, he finds favor with the warden and he's put in charge of all of the other prisoners. So we have this kind of pattern of disappointment rising above it and moving forward with resolve. And he resolves that he's going to make the best out of pretty much every situation that he's put into. And while he's in prison, there are two men from the Pharaoh's household who are thrown into prison. There's a baker and there's a cupkeeper. And the baker has a dream one night, and it's kind of a crazy dream. And Joseph interprets it that he's going to be beheaded. And then the cupmaker has a dream, and which is also a crazy dream. And Joseph says, you are going to be found that you're not guilty. You're going to be released back to Pharaoh's house. And when this happens, please, please, please tell Pharaoh who I am and what I can do. And so, as it so happens, the baker is beheaded and the cupmaker is released to Pharaoh's household. But he forgets about Joseph. And so Joseph is left in prison for another 2 years. And after that 2 years, Pharaoh begins having some pretty disturbing dreams, and he's quite upset. He's not eating, he's not sleeping, his health is really going downhill. And his advisors, they've got like mystics and psychics and dream tellers from all over Egypt coming to try and interpret his dreams. And nothing is working. And eventually, his servant that was in prison with Joseph, he remembers that Joseph interpreted his dream and it came true. And so he tells Pharaoh, he's like, I know a guy. Let me bring him to you. And so he goes and he gets Joseph out of prison. He brings him to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh is like, okay. Like, this guy, he's young. He's not Egyptian. He's, been falsely accused, which, Pharaoh doesn't know at this point, but he's been in prison for a long time, But whatever you say, I will go ahead. I will tell him my dreams and we'll see what happens. So Pharaoh recounts two dreams to Joseph. And Joseph takes a moment to think on it. And then he begins to tell Pharaoh that both of his dreams are the same. They have the same meaning. There will be 7 years of abundance followed up by 7 years of famine. And he lays out a plan for Pharaoh to use the time during the 7 years of abundance to store grain and put aside everything that they will need to then lead them through the 7 years of famine. And Pharaoh is so impressed that he makes Joseph his second in command over all of Egypt, and he authorizes him to do whatever he needs to do so that they will have enough for the years of famine. So here we have this teenage boy who was betrayed by his brothers, sold into Egypt. He rises above everything that happens to him after that, from false accusations, imprisonment, slavery, rises above it all, never losing his faith in God. And he's determined to follow God's plan wherever that takes him. And he becomes like a king in a foreign land. And soon after the start of the famine, his brothers come to Egypt to try and buy some grain. And there's forgiveness and there's reconnecting, and they bring their families to join him here. They live there, they prosper, they multiply for many years. And so now we've come full circle to Joseph's dreams, in which his family is multiplying and they're bowing down to him. Joseph's faith in God gave him the resilience to do better, whether it was managing Potiphar's house, leading in prison, or governing in Egypt. And his story shows us that disappointments are not the end, but they are a chance to grow. Disappointment often accompanies human failure, and we're all human and we fail 9 times out of 10. But the Bible teaches us that if we have faith in God, He will make up for our shortcomings. But He doesn't spare us from the disappointment, because it helps us grow into the person that He knows that we are and that we can be and that He wants us to be. We often feel like our feelings of disappointment, sadness, fear, grief, pain, happiness, joy, you know, all of these human emotions, that they're just too small for the Creator to even think about or care about. But in Psalms 126, we're told, "They that sow in tears shall reap in joy." King David cries out to the Lord in Psalms 56, saying, "Be gracious to me, O Lord, in the midst of this troubling time. This I know, God is for me, and in God I trust, and I shall not be afraid. For God remembers all things that happen in our lives. He's a tender-hearted Father. He feels with us, and He weeps with us." So never forget, in your times of disappointment, no matter what they are, that disappointment is not too small for God to remember and to be with you. It's a beautiful day outside, guys. It's the start of the weekend. I want you to go make the most of it. Strike up a conversation with somebody on the bus, on the train, in the subway, at the grocery store, wherever you find yourself. Try to strike up a conversation with somebody and find a common thread. Enjoy your day and have a great weekend. And thank you so much for joining me.